Hello, and welcome again to another Conservative Historian podcast. This one entitled, Not Rhinos, Kinos Are the Problem. The date is March 2023, and my name is Bell Avis. Those damned Latin names. Whenever classical names come up, there is something always kind of lost in translation. Why do the two most prominent Catos come with the pronunciation of a hard C? The first Cato was called the censor, another soft C word, who opposed Scipio Africanus, and the second was the younger, Marcus Porcius, see again, hard C, soft C, who opposed Caesar, soft C. Both Catos are always pronounced with a hard C, as in Cato, yet Cicero, or Caesar himself, is pronounced phonetically as Cicero, or Caesar. So in trying out the term kino, or conservative in name only, I have a difficult choice. So in deference to the Catos, not to be confused with Bruce Lee's role as the Green Hornet's sidekick, nor of Bert Kwok, who played Cato in the Pink Panther series, I will go with the hard C, as in kino. Not only does it honor the more conservative figures from the late Roman Republic leadership, but as conservative uses the hard C, so I will with Kino. In this era of Trump, Fox News, and the likes of Lauren Boebert, the term rhino no longer really means anything because it has been warped to mean someone who, essentially, is not a Trumpist. So Mitch McConnell, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Paul Ryan, Jeb Bush, and most importantly, Ron DeSantis, who by certain definitions are very conservative politicians, well, they're now rhinos in the estimation of the arbiters of such things, Trump and his sycophants. The concept of a Republican, when looked at historically, is, well, a little changeable. Benjamin Harrison was a Republican. He also expanded government on a scale and size never before seen in the Republic, with the possible exception of Lincoln during the Civil War. He used the public purse to award constituencies. Grover Cleveland, the Democrat who ran against Harrison in two elections, believed in small government, free trade, and was pro-business. So, is Harrison the rhino in this context? And is Cleveland some sort of a dino? Not to be confused with the Flintstones dog, mind you. What we need is a definition and a framework of conservatism. How exactly do we define conservative? Well, there are several possibilities. Are conservatives against change? Where do they stand on foreign policy? And are they for smaller government? To find these answers, let's look at one of the founders of conservatism, Edmund Burke. Though Burke initially supported the American Revolution on the grounds of taxation without representation, he was not as supportive of the French version. In his Reflections on the Revolution in France, he started with sympathies towards the aims of the French, but soon grew concerned about the new polity's removal of institutions and its replacement by that of the will of the majority and an early sort of, well, what I'll call proto-populism. Burke noted, "If I reflect rightly, Aristotle observes that democracy has many striking points of resemblance with a tyranny. Of this I am certain, that in a democracy the majority of citizens is capable of exercising the cruelest oppressions upon the minority whenever strong divisions prevail in that kind of polity." You see, Burke understood that a state that had omitted institutions that would place a curb or a guardrail on the whims and passions of the people was a necessary part of government. Burke was a strong believer in individual liberty, but without guardrails, without institutions, without the norms now so denigrated by the left, and more increasingly those on the right, who have joined those on the left, liberty becomes the ability for one group of individuals to oppress another. Burke went on to say, "I should therefore suspend my congratulations on the new liberty of France until I was informed how it had been combined with government, with the public force, with the discipline and obedience of armies, with the collection of an effective and well-distributed revenue, with morality and religion, with the solidity of property, with peace and order, and with civil and social manners. From the time of Woodrow Wilson and his living constitution, up to Barack Obama's pen and phone, and Joe Biden's lawless forgiveness, I put that in quotes, forgiveness. I can't stand that word, forgiveness, as if Joe Biden's some sort of a high priest who's doling out forgiveness of student debt. The left has acted that if enough people want something, well, heck, that is justification for the removal of barriers to that desire, even up to and including the abrogation of the Constitution, as we have seen in the form of Biden's student debt remission, which essentially is a revenue giveaway that only Congress can enact. And lately, the right, as it wanted to do, has acted in kind. The left acts and the right reacts. To build this southern border wall, Donald Trump also engaged in extra-constitutional behavior. That is not really conservatism. Other figures defining conservatism, who predated Burke, would include John Locke, who believed in individual liberty and property rights. The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it, which obliges everyone, and reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind. Who will but consult it, that being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, his health, his liberty, or his possessions. Another of these figures includes Montesquieu, who noted, "We must have constantly present in our minds the difference between independence and liberty. Liberty is a right of doing whatever the laws permit, and if a citizen could do what they forbid, he would no longer be possessed of liberty." Now, much of conservatism, especially the English kind, has some differentiations from the American. So let's turn to an American conservative. Among the greatest of these thinkers, I would list Russell Kirk, influenced by Burke, to be among the top group. Kirk outlined 6 key principles. I will enumerate these here and add some of my own commentary. Kirk believed in a body of natural laws, as we have seen with Locke, in this case, listed in the Declaration of Independence. Kirk believed affection for the proliferating variety and mystery of human existence, as opposed to the narrowing uniformity. The left loves to talk about diversity, but what they're really talking about is actually a conformity, a uniformity of thought. It is conservatives who believe in that variety and mystery of human existence. Third, conviction that civilized society requires orders and classes is against the notion of a classless society. I would argue that where classless societies have been attempted, oligarchical rule forms. We will hear from the likes of Bernie Sanders of this world that the perfect socialist order has never really been tried. I would disagree. It has been tried, and the results have been horrific. At best, an oligarchy. At worst, a tyrannical or authoritarian order that often leads to the crushing of dissent, in many cases, through mass murder. Number 4 on Kirk's list, persuasion that freedom and property are closely linked. I would not say property to mean necessarily land, but rather having ownership, that there is protection over that ownership. 5. Distrust of sophisters, calculators, and economists who would reconstruct society upon abstract designs. Custom, convention, and old prescription are checks both upon man's anarchic impulse and upon the innovator's lust for power. When I read this, I think of Elizabeth Warren and her plan for everything. Boy, talk about a lust for power. See, Elizabeth Warren would plan out everything in, I'm certain, a perfect order. And of course, in doing her order and her plan, she would basically obliterate a lot of the norms and institutions and guardrails that I've referred to before. But it's all for the best. And after all, Elizabeth Warren knows better, right? And 6 on Kirk's list, recognition that change may not be salutary reform. Hasty innovation may be devouring conflagration. rather than a torch of progress. Society must alter for prudent change is the means of social preservation. Again, Kirk is not saying, well, we're just going to freeze everything in amber. And I would say that we've made great strides in our society, especially as regards some of the inclusion that we have seen over the last 50 years. But as Kirk would note, a statesman must take providence into his calculations, and a statesman's chief virtue, according to Plato and Burke, is prudence. At nearly every college convocation, we hear the extolling of change. In business, we celebrate the change agent. I would contend that prudence and circumspection of change are more important than simply change in and of itself. And as a capitalist, obviously I support change, but not for change's sake. The beauty of capitalism is that the change is channeled, the change is logical, the change is directed towards something that has been thought about and prudent, because a good capitalist does not allocate their capital without thinking about where to do it. If you haven't, then you're probably one of those people who invested heavily in FTX and are now sitting there wondering, what the heck happened to all my money? And when thinking of the modern GOP, I cannot help but cite this from Kirk. Men cannot improve a society by setting fire to it. They must seek out its old virtues and bring them back into the light. Now, Charles Krauthammer commented a great deal upon our governmental system, another great conservative. As he stated, under our constitutional system, the executive executes the laws that Congress has passed. It should not be executing laws that Congress has rejected. Is forgiving the student debt anything that is a good policy or a bad one? I would say no, because I think there's a horrible moral hazard in it. But if Congress actually passed a law forgiving all of that student debt, and then Biden signed it, I would have to live with it. I would oppose it. I'd vigorously debate it. But once it became law and passed muster from the judiciary, that is how the system is supposed to work. And that is exactly not what Joe Biden is doing here. Now, Charles Krauthammer also commented on American exceptionalism. Every civilization is founded on sins. Every single one. Dispossession, violence, appropriation. What distinguishes civilizations are the ones who rise above it. What Krauthammer here is saying is that every time the left wants to cite something like our racist past, which is a stain, our treatment of women sometimes, which has been a stain in our history, but have we risen above it? My answer, and I've said this several times throughout podcasts, we have elected an African-American president. We have not one, not two, but four women on the Supreme Court. We have two African-Americans on the Supreme Court, 22% of the Supreme Court. I have said all these things before because we are a civilization who has risen above some of the problems that occurred at our inception. And here I present what would be termed conservative economists. One of the greatest of them is Friedrich Hayek, who outlined his beliefs in works such as The Constitution of Liberty, The Fatal Conceit, The Errors of Socialism, and The Road to Serfdom. Our freedom of choice in a competitive society rests on the fact that if one person refuses to satisfy our wishes, we can turn to another. But if we faced a monopolist, we are at his absolute mercy. And an authority directing the whole economic system of the country would be the most powerful monopolist conceivable. It would have complete power to decide what we are to be given, on what terms. It would not only decide what commodities and services were to be available, in what quantities, it would be able to direct their distributions between persons to any degree it liked. Another of these great economists is Milton Friedman, who noted, "The Great Depression, like most other periods of severe unemployment, was produced by government mismanagement rather than by any inherent instability of the private economy." These are concepts of conservatism in which I believe, But am I simply cherry-picking to make a later point? After all, a belief system hundreds of years old and utilized as a harness for political achievement is subject to a host of interpretations. In a 2003 article in the American Conservative magazine, writer Owen Harry states, "Conservatism does not lend itself easily to schematic, didactic exposition, and conservatives, well, they do not readily engage in it." And it was William F. Buckley who famously stated that a conservative is someone who stands athwart history yelling stop at a time when no one is inclined to do so or to have much patience with those who so urge it. And Harris goes on to note, in an article called Conservatism as an Ideology, published in 1957, Samuel Huntington observes that, unlike nearly every other ideology, conservatism offers no vision of an ideal society. There is no conservative utopia. Indeed, conservatism has no substantive institutional content. It has been used to defend all sorts of different institutional arrangements, from traditional to feudal to liberal to capitalist to social democratic. Because it is concerned not with content, but with process, with change and stability, its true opposite is not liberalism, but radicalism. Conservatism advances arguments that stress the difficulty and danger of rapid change and the importance of stability and continuity and prudence. Radicalism expresses enthusiasm concerning innovation and boldness in embracing change. I would agree with Harris's contention about radicalism, and part of this podcast is to note its rise on the right. The problem with this concept is that as an argument rooted in the British tradition, if it is radical to remove the concept of royalty and nobility, something America was intent on doing, then is preserving this conservatism? Yet there are certain views that when with the concept of conservatism is broached, there are clear commonalities. And I will start with the brilliant. In George Will's 2019 masterpiece, A Conservative Sensibility, the author sets out exactly what we aim to conserve. In Will's estimation, and one I agree with, we aim to conserve the founding. The elucidation of natural rights in the Declaration and the separation of powers of a limited constitution create a limited government. As Will notes, America was born with an epistemological assertion. The important political truths are not merely knowable, they are known. They are self-evident in that they are obvious to any mind not clouded by ignorance or superstition. It is, the Declaration says, self-evidently true that all men are created equal, not only in their access to the important political truths, but also in being endowed with certain inalienable rights, including the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Perhaps, though, the most important word in the Declaration is the word secure. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. The government's primary purpose is to secure pre-existing rights. The government does not create rights, it does not dispense them. Also, Connor Friedersdorf, writing in The Atlantic, provides a list that, in addition to Will's definition, includes the belief that it is imperative to preserve traditional morality, as it is articulated in the Bible, that there is a consciousness of the fallibility of man. In other words, think about that prudence, and an awareness of the values of skepticism, doubt, and humility and realism in foreign policy. So in addition to all of the people I have cited and dozens more that I could, I don't just because of time, I also searched through several existing politicians' websites who put a claim upon conservatism. After sifting through all of this, and foundationally supported by, well, probably 20 years of thinking about this stuff, I, the intrepid conservative historian, will establish what I see as the 9 key parameters of conservatism as defined in the context of the United States of America. First, individual liberty. Second, institutions to curb the exigencies of individual liberty when it is turned into group identity. Property rights, that would be number 3. Number 4, the concept of separation of powers and checks and balances inherent in the Constitution. Number five, arguably one of the more important of these, a market-based economy. And the absolutely critical corollary to this is a small, limited government with less regulation. Six, a belief in American exceptionalism. We alone, among the nations on this earth, were founded on ideals, not entirely on geography, migration, or conquest. And because we pursue those ideals, as Charles Krauthammer stated earlier, we rise above. Seven, strong foreign presence, but eschew the conceit that we can impose our values on other nations or peoples. Eight, belief in family and morality. There is yet another article within the Wall Street Journal simply saying that married people live longer. The marriage is the core of the family, and the family needs to be the core of the state, not the state is the core of a family. And finally, rejection of relativism. So, if a rhino is now a meaningless term, what is a kino? Well, frankly, Trump is a kino. Up until 2016, the Republican Party was known as the more conservative of the two major parties, including pillars rested on small government, pro-business, and a robust foreign policy. As noted, this was not always the case. In the late 1800s, as I talked about earlier, it was the Grover Cleveland-led Bourbon Democrats who favored these things. Republican Benjamin Harrison presided over veteran benefits and the first $1 billion in federal spending. And even as late as 1912, not one, but two Republican presidents, Teddy Roosevelt and William Taft, favored the progressive, interventionist type of government. The Republican Party we recognize today was really, in my opinion, the creation of William Harding and most of all Calvin Coolidge. And the Democratic Party today, begun with Wilson, achieved its full radical big government status under Franklin Roosevelt, a consistency only briefly interrupted by the presidency of Bill Clinton in the 1990s. And even these labels are not entirely consistent. In the 1930s, the Republicans went through a periodic spasm of American first wishing for neutrality. Remember how I said that conservatives are realists? That, thinking that we could somehow stay out of World War II, that is one of those things in which realism would have told us the answer was no. For most of the 20th century, it was Democratic presidents who fought the wars, but it should be noted that both Wilson in World War I and Roosevelt in World War II were dragged reluctantly into these conflicts. Wilson, who only won his 1912 election because of the split between Taft and Teddy Roosevelt, won in 1916 in his own right with the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And even interventions by Truman in Korea and Johnson in Vietnam were, well, kind of Cold War conflicts. It was not as if Eisenhower and Nixon were American firsters in the mold of, let's say, a Henry Cabot Lodge. And one of the ways Johnson won his 1964 landslide election was to portray his opponent, Barry Goldwater, as a bloodthirsty warmonger who would preside over World War III. The concept of America as an intervener realized its full Republican form under Reagan, who owed at least part of his election to his predecessor, Jimmy Carter's ineffectual response to the Iran hostage crisis. And Reagan's two immediate GOP successors, H.W. George Bush, intervened forcefully in the Middle East, and it is here where I would draw a clear distinction between H.W. Bush the father and W. the son. In the former case, he acted only after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and threatened Saudi Arabia. And in W.'s first act, he rightly ejected al-Qaeda from Afghanistan and the Taliban from power in that nation. But where W. differentiated from conservative beliefs was in his invasion of Iraq under false threats in 2003. If there was a Bush doctrine, it was that of preventive wars. But if we deployed for every potential threat, we would soon exhaust our options. But this is not to say that interventions are not necessary, as was the case in Kuwait. And I believe this principle applies to Ukraine. is not the invasion itself, but also the threat to NATO, combined with well-documented involvement in our election processes, which entails vigorous support of Ukraine. And on domestic policy, some of the distinctions may have, well, blurred a bit. Eisenhower created the interstate highway system, and it was Nixon who launched the EPA. Yet when compared with the likes of Lyndon B. Johnson or Barack Obama from 1912 to 2016, it was a safe bet that the Democratic Party's answer to almost any domestic issue was more government, and often in an extra constitutional fashion, in a way that Republicans could not match. What's interesting is one of the small and rare departures from this is their view on crime. Here, there's a Democratic movement, Defund the Police, in which they actually want less government, albeit on a local level. If you ask them if they wanted to constitute a national police force, I think they would probably be on board. And now, let's go back and view those squishes, those so-called rhinos, these people who are Republican in name only. Trump recently commented that Florida was doing, well under Rick Scott and Charlie Crist. He actually praised Charlie Crist, who was a Democrat, who actually was a Democrat as recently as a few months ago when he ran against Ron DeSantis. But Trump praises Crist because, of course, the enemy of my enemy, I guess, and his enemy in this case is DeSantis. He did this to denigrate DeSantis' achievements, of course. Typical of Trump, he left a few things out. First, it was Crist that DeSantis beat like a drum in 2022, when Trump candidates were also at the same time getting eviscerated. DeSantis won that election by 20%, which was more than any GOP governor before him. And that, before DeSantis, Scott, or Crist, there was another guy who actually provided the template, the playbook, the governance that all subsequent GOPers have followed to create dominance of the third largest state, not seen in any other place. Who was that guy who wrote the playbook, who provided the template? Well, that would be Jeb Bush. Oh, Jeb Bush. He's low energy, isn't he? Isn't that what Trump labeled him? And then, like a schoolyard taunt, it actually stuck. I always think that's kind of an interesting thing, low energy, because after all, what we really want with our presidencies is high energy. Unless that is one would be, a conservative. Under our constitutional government, the role of the president is to execute the laws that Congress states. It is not a role of high priest. It is not a role of team cheerleader. It's driving me a little crazy that when any kind of thing happens in the states, a river overflows its banks or anything, the president has to show up and walk around like they're the mayor, the governor, they're everything now, almost like a priest king. This is driving me a little crazy. At this point, a true conservative might like a little low energy and high competence within the role of the chief executive of the United States. They don't make the laws. They don't set the tone, or at least they shouldn't. That should be Congress's role. And they don't need to govern my life. Again, maybe a little low energy might not be the worst thing in the executive. Let's see, though. Remember I said low energy and high competence? So what exactly was Jeb's tenure like? Well, here's his track record in Florida. Florida added, during Jeb's governorship, he did two terms, 8 years. Florida added 1.32 million jobs during Bush's 8 years, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics charts. As reference points, Wisconsin during that period added 162,000 jobs under Scott Walker, and Texas added 2.25 million jobs during Rick Perry's 14 years as governors there. Florida's GDP grew an average of 7.2% during Bush's 10 years. Bush cut Florida taxes by $19 billion. He imposed sales tax holidays, scrapped a $10 annual car emissions test, and got rid of intangibles tax that saved stock investors and money savers more than $1 billion a year. And then there's Jeb's record on education. Bush had a six-point plan that he imposed from his time in 1999 all the way through 2008. What were those plans? Good old-fashioned common sense on education. He graded schools on simple A through F scale. that were on student standardized test scores. This is an era in which a lot of elite universities want to eliminate test scores. He did high-stakes testing. He required students to meet grade standards before promotion to higher grade. He paid teachers on student performance. What a crazy concept that is. He found new methods to credential teachers, and most importantly, he added charter schools, private school vouchers, and online schools to offer parents more choices. This is not to ignore the good work by Rick Scott or Ron DeSantis, but again, the template was built by Jeb. Paul Ryan is another Trump punching bag. Quote, Paul Ryan is a loser. Mitt Romney could have won without him. Really? A vice president makes that much of a difference? But, well, what is the real Ryan? In a piece by left-leaning PBS, the article noted, Ryan developed a reputation as a numbers-obsessed policy wonk, that rare politician more interested in poring over budget briefing books than in attending glitzy social and political events around Washington. And in 2016, Ryan engineered a massive, massive tax cut. But much of Trump's ire is aimed at another part of Ryan's policies, his proposal for the reform of entitlements. What Trump does not say, will never say, is that if there is not a reform, Medicare will have to be forced to cuts in 7 years, and Social Security will see an automatic 25% haircut by 2031, 8 short years from now. Ryan was trying to preserve entitlements by applying conservative principles. Trump thinks pixies will materialize and sprinkle gold dust on entitlements, and the problem will simply go away. As Ryan notes, by failing seriously to confront the most predictable economic crisis in our nation's history, the president's policies are committing us and our children to a diminished future. And in this distinction of kino versus true conservatives, it is hard not to conjure the greatest conservative president of the past 80 years. In a piece in the New Criterion, writer George H. Nash notes Reagan articulating the conservative philosophy that emerged in the 20th century. In the 1980s, the Reagan administration's policies of tax rate cutting, deregulation, and encouragement of private sector economic growth were the direct product of this rich intellectual legacy of conservatism. More recently, the Republican Party agenda for tax cutting can be traced intellectually to the supply-side orthodoxy that captured that party during the Reagan era and remained ascendant for the next 30 years. Yet some things have changed a little bit. Rich Lowry, writing in Politico a few weeks ago about the new rejection of Reaganism in the Trump era, notes, in his CPAC speech last weekend, doubling down on MAGA, Trump said, we are never going back to the party of Paul Ryan, Karl Rove, and Jeb Bush. He didn't mention Reagan, but the inclusion of the Gipper in the Hall of Shame was heavily implied. This way of thinking in a Republican primary is something new. Once upon a time, pretty much every Republican wanted to be a Reagan Republican. If the Trump camp gets its way, Reaganism will have gone from passé in 2016 to an affirmative vulnerability in 2024. Lurie adds on Reagan's accomplishments. Reagan's achievements are momentous and should be acknowledged as such by all Republican factions. He set the predicate for winning the Cold War without firing a shot. He slayed inflation, both by sticking by Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker, despite considerable political pressure to buckle, and by pursuing pro-growth policies that created more supply in the economy. Reagan ended the energy crisis. His administration gave a boost to the nascent conservative legal movement that has led us up to decisions such as Dobbs and EPA. He brought a new constituency into the Republican Party, the so-called Reagan Democrats, an analog of Democrats who would vote for Trump, and forced a turn to the center of the Democratic Party under Bill Clinton. He changed the mood of the country. That is Reagan's legacy. Oh, and one other thing. It should also be noted that Reagan was a winner. He won two elections in California. He won his first presidential win in 1980 and, in 1984, his landslide. the last such landslide election of that magnitude in the past 40 years. I would take 4-0 versus 1-4. One not need be an expert in Boolean logic to know which to prefer. And it is not just the Trump aspect that is altering the definition of what we understand to be conservative. The horrifically misnamed Lincoln Project, an organization seemingly dedicated to corruption and graft by benefiting by anti-Trump animus, is about as true conservative, by my definition, as Fidel Castro. Daniel Kurtzleben, writing for NPR in January 2023, noted, "This sort of America first, nativist, ethnocentric, even racist kind of appeals is where he's like, let's get out of NAFTA and let's not let companies be woke. Some of these completely fly in the face of a free market economy, free trade, traditional Republican coalition." This is where the Kino label asserts itself. Ashley Hayek, executive director of the pro-Trump group American First Works, believes both that Trump's ideology is conservative and that he changed conservatism. It was exposing the gap between the consultants and the people, and that permanently altered people's expectations overall, she said. "So I think conservatism is, you know, putting power back to the American people." The unfortunately named Hayek, Friedrich is probably turning in his grave on this link, incorrectly equates conservatism with populism. And it is not small government conservatism that utilizes the term the people. The second most powerful nation on earth is titled the People's Republic of China to better align itself with the core Marxism inherent in the government. It was Howard Zinn, the hack, a socialist historian, who titled his book The People's History of the United States. Kurtzelbaum adds, "But the debate still raises an important question. If today's conservatism is defined by Trump, what happens as his influence wanes? Michael Steele, former RNC chair, worries the party has no ideology right now. It didn't adopt a new platform in 2020, and Trump opponents like former Representative Liz Cheney are now out of power. We don't even have a platform. How do we define ourselves? We can't even tell you what we believe," he said. "You know, everybody talking about Liz Cheney is conservative. Liz is conservative on a lot of things, but Liz got herself kicked out of the party." Charlie Sykes, writer for the Bulwark Platform, notes, "It's whoever can play most effectively to the media wing of the Republican Party, who can anger the left, who promises to fight and inflict damage on the left more aggressively. That is what defines conservatism today." Kurtzelbaum states, "From that point of view, what it now means to be conservative might be described as simply opposing liberals." And if ever there was a rejection of conservatism by Trump, it was in his recent CPAC statement last month. "Today I add, I am your warrior, I am your justice, and for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution." There is very little in conservative that would justify a strong man, a so-called warrior, well, one who actually never actually served as a real warrior, righting all of our wrongs. Here we come to the difference between a conservative and a populist. Nash again, in his aptly titled Populism I, The Problem of Conservatism and Populism. In its simplest terms, populism, defined as the revolt of ordinary people against overbearing and self-serving elites, has long existed in American politics. In its most familiar form, populism has been left-wing in its ideology, targeting bankers, wealthy capitalists, and corporations as villains, the millionaires and billionaires in Bernie Sanders' parlance. From Andrew Jackson's feud with the Second Bank of the United States to William Jennings Bryan's crusade against the gold standard, from Franklin Roosevelt's appeal to the forgotten man at the bottom of the economic period in 1932 to the demagogic theatrics of Huey Long and Father Charles Coughlin in his early days during the Great Depression, populism has quite often been a left-wing phenomenon, vocalizing the anger of those at the bottom of the economic ladder towards those sitting pretty at the top. In defining the Trump populism, Nash notes, "So what manner of rough beast is this? It's our come round at last. I believe we are witnessing, in inchoate form, a phenomenon as never before seen in this country, an ideologically muddled nationalist populist major party combining both left-wing and right-wing elements. Two obstacles, however, stand in the path of such an accommodation. The first is that the contest between Trumpism and its conservative critics has become not just a dispute over details of public policy, but an all-out war of ideas, one not easily papered over by pragmatic compromise. To many of his conservative critics, Trumpism is little more than a mishmash of protectionist, nativist, and in foreign policy, neo-isolationist impulses. To the Trumpists, conservative internationalism is a rusty relic of a bygone era and supply-side economics, with its corollaries of free trade, open border, and uncapped immigration, is an ossified dogma whose real-world consequences have been catastrophic for globalization's losers. When the issues that Trump originally rose to address, from political and cultural realignment, pitting, in the words of social science, globalist and transnational progressive elites against those who style themselves nationalist and populist, or a deepening conviction that the governing elites have neither the competence nor the will to make things better. But there are two problems with Trump's approach to this. Number one, populism, as far as is trying to help out the losers from globalization or any of those others, will not help. If he is the guy and the only guy in his estimation who actually can provide that kind of help to people, how is that so different from Elizabeth Warren saying that she's the one who is going to offer all the kind of help? True conservative principles could help. Trump's populism will not help. That's number one. And number two is, he won't be in any position to help because Trump can't get elected. But I will address that in another podcast. So what I would like to do now is to do a simple comparison. Remember those principles that I laid out? And this is after, again, that exhaustive research into what would be termed, at least at a high level, those principles of conservatism. Let's look at them. The first one is individual liberty. Now, ostensibly, Trump is in favor of that. But again, Trump tends towards what I would call authoritarian impulses. And if you crossed him, if you went up against him, if he didn't agree with you, would Trump be interested in individual liberty in that regard? Think about the second one, institutions to curb the exigencies of individual liberty when it turned into group identity. Exactly the same thing. Trump is very willing to overturn norms, remove institutions, and do those things that are necessary to accrue to his power and his authority. Now you say to yourself, but this is necessary because look at all of the things that the left has done. My response to that is that good, solid conservative principles are not only better than populist ones, but that if we have lost the institutions we need, then let's take them back. And no other greater example exists of that today than the Supreme Court. For 50 years, we labored under a Roe regime, and that got overturned. But it wasn't overturned because we destroyed the institution of the Supreme Court. No, that was overturned because we had a concerted, disciplined, thoughtful effort to get judges elected into the appellates and district courts, and therefore set it up that when a president would come along who would nominate the necessary justices, we had a pool of qualified candidates who would not be David Souters, but rather would be more like Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia, or, as is the cases we now have, solid conservative jurists. How about property rights? Well, I actually think he's a believer in that for the most part. But the next one, the concept of separation of powers and checks and balances inherent in the Constitution, I think that one's clearly a no. And now, the next one, a market-based economy, and the corollary to that is a small, limited government with less regulation. One of his first acts as president was to cut taxes on a train corporation, particularly a factory in Indiana. I'm sorry, even though that was good because it brought manufacturing jobs, it wasn't a policy or tax breaks across the entire manufacturing thing, something passed by Congress. No, he did that from executive action. He did many things from executive action that were anathema to a true market-based economy. How about American exceptionalism? Does Donald Trump, who gave probably one of the most dour verdicts on the United States in his inaugural address, actually believe in the power of America? I think he believes in the power of himself, but I never have felt that he had vested it within America. And a strong foreign presence, but eschew the conceit that we impose our values on other nations or peoples, we cannot simply withdraw from the world. I'm not saying we do Iraq-style invasions. I'm not saying we do Vietnam-style incursions. No, but we can't bury our heads in the sand. We're either going to fight them there or we're going to fight them here, and we might as well think about how we're going to do that. And then there's belief in family and morality. And in this, maybe more than any other, Trump completely falls short. There was a time, not really that long ago, 20 years ago, in which William Bennett, former education secretary in the Bush administration, wrote what was called a book of virtues. Conservatives had many things labeled against them, but one of the things, at least in those days, that weren't, was that we were the more moral, the more family-oriented group. With Trump, we can never claim that. And then finally, a rejection of relativism. To Trump, everything is relevant to himself. So piece by piece, conservative ideological check against conservative ideological check, Trump is not a true conservative. And as I said before, what he is a populist. Trump and populism are not only not conservative, but they won't work. At the core, populism is the supposed will of the people. But when Trump talks about retribution, is he really talking about the people's or his own? At the core, populism is always a leader whose interests will, in time, end up counter to the interests of the people. This is a core pillar of history, ranging from Octavian to Lenin to Mao to Bernie Sanders, he of the complaint of millionaires, but the possessor of three residences. The issue between the haves and have-nots is that as the power of government grows, and the power of those who wield its power gain greater influence, the power of individual liberty diminishes. At no point does Trump or his acolytes articulate a lessening of governmental power. Instead, he talks of, well, more of it in his own hands. Even assuming that he's not playing a long game of grift, which I'm not too certain about, who is to succeed to the power accrued by the 76-year-old Trump? His children? Marjorie Taylor Greene? Carrie Lake? Those who cry out that the government should do something never even ask for data on what has actually happened when the government did something compared to what actually happened when the government did nothing. That was from Thomas Sowell. One of the greatest threats to individual liberty and achievement will come from the government. And conservatives, true conservatives, will always work to lessen this power. And whether they call themselves conservative or not, if they do not embrace the values that have been extolled and talked about throughout this podcast, then they are conservatives in name only. Thank you for listening to this latest of the Conservative Historian Podcast. Please check out all of our other podcasts. Next week, we will be talking about the fog of war throughout history. This is Bell Office. Thanks for listening.